content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll start today with an article from the December 31st, 2024 online edition of the New Yorker. Why can't you just deal with it? Often it's our most obviously necessary tasks that feel the most impossible. By Joshua Rothman. You have something important to do, something vital. It's not an item on a list, but a burdensome project, urgent and complicated. Your home office must be transformed into a nursery for a baby due next month. Your late father's house must be sold to pay for your daughter's college education. You've owed your boss a report for a year, and with each passing week, it grows more difficult to complete. You have to file this year's taxes and last year's, and the documents you need are lost in your spare room in nondescript envelopes you've never opened. Why can't you just deal with it? It's a question you can ask yourself in bed at night or in the mirror the next morning. Procrastination is one thing. We've all put off writing thank you notes or responding to emails and survived with our dignity intact. Not dealing with it is different. It's what we experience when a lot is being asked of us and we're not rising to the occasion. The issue is not procrastination. You're trying, but defeat. There's a lot I'm not dealing with right now, which I won't get into, so as not to freak myself out. But let's imagine that a well-meaning hypothetical person, call him Jay, needs to make a difficult medical decision on behalf of an incapacitated older relative. Should the relative be subjected to an optional, arduous procedure that will be deeply unpleasant, but possibly beneficial in the long term? Or should the not inconsiderable risks of the procedure serve as justification for foregoing it? Having consulted with a number of doctors, Jay is stuck. There are many possible next steps, including seeking further opinions or deciding definitively not to proceed. For now, the situation hangs in midair, undealt with like a bomb that's soon to land. It's a waste of time and energy to keep thinking about something that you make no progress on. The to-do guru David Allen writes in his productivity opus, Getting Things Done. Accordingly, the best course of action is to find some small way of moving forward, no matter how incremental it may seem. Yet, our most oppressive problems seem to resist this kind of measured, sensible approach. Right or wrong, we feel that something above and beyond is required. You can't retake France from the Nazis by launching little operations here and there. You need D-Day. You cannot untie a Gordian knot by tugging a little on random bits of string. You need to identify and yank on the most important loops in just the right sequence. According to some versions of the legend, Alexander the Great gave up on untying the knot and just cut through it with his sword. But in real life, that's rarely a viable plan. We have to keep poking and prodding our knottiest problems. When we find that we lack the fortitude to continue, we have no choice but to admit that we're failing to deal. Simple jobs, getting new windshield wipers for the car, making room for a new bike in the garage, do not need to be dealt with. They can be addressed directly, without much drama. Dealing comes into it when problems become not just complicated, but too complicated. If you need to sell your late father's house, you have to decide what to do with his stuff. Should you junk his jazz records? Sell his possibly valuable vintage movie posters? If the place is run down, you have to figure out whether you should invest in it before selling, and then manage whatever projects it might involve. You live on the other side of the country, And so you have to make room in your schedule for traveling and seeing the place. This concatenation of factors pretty much guarantees that you'll kick yourself years later for bad decisions you make now. A sort of imposter syndrome can creep in. Are you really someone capable of dealing with stuff like this? Once, when I was struggling to deal, I called a friend. "Look, you're an intelligent and sensible person," she said. "So whatever decisions you make, they'll be intelligent and sensible, even if they turn out to be wrong." It was the perfect thing to say. Accepting both my fallibility and my capability helped me move forward. Emotions deepen the complexity. If that home office you need to transform into a nursery is where you work on your personal projects, your novel, your songs, your code, then the prospect of emptying it might make you not just wistful, but afraid. Practical questions, should you throw out your old files or scan them, can take on existential weight. Will parenthood mean the end of your personal life? You can fall into a kind of affective spiral in which you can't deal with a problem because you feel bad, and you feel bad because you cannot deal with the problem. I sometimes break out of these loops by imagining my future self telling the story of how I persevered. I was sad when I was doing it, I'll someday say, but in the end it was fine. A saving grace of emotional life is that feelings fade. What you build today will still exist a year from now, and what you feel will not. Recently, like a typical 45-year-old man, I was in the gym trying to best my personal record in the deadlift. Matt, a trainer I see every few weeks, had suggested that I put far more weight on the bar than usual, and when I tried to move it, it didn't even budge. "Just keep working," he said. "Use sustained effort. Keep going, and it will lift." I braced myself, gripped the bar, and pushed against the ground with my legs for 2 seconds, then three, then four, without result. Until suddenly, as if by magic, the bar came off the ground and the lift was complete. Ever since, I've thought of sustained effort as a particular way of dealing with a problem. I do not know what was happening while I was trying to lift the bar, but couldn't. Perhaps it took time to get through what's sometimes called the sticking point of the lift, the position at which it's most difficult. Many problems require long periods of sustained and seemingly fruitless effort. A painter may have to waste a lot of canvas before she starts making the paintings she wants. Similarly, someone may have to hold a lot of repetitive conversations with medical specialists before he learns what he needs to know. Maybe, when we say that we're not dealing with it, what we really mean is that we're not used to failing for so long. Actually, we are dealing with it, but slowly. Of course, there are stranger reasons that we can't deal. Philosophers used the term akrasia, an ancient Greek word meaning weakness of the will, to describe the habit of taking actions you actually don't want to take, or of failing to do what you've decided to do. In theory, you are experiencing akrasia when you eat a second piece of cake, even though you know it's a bad idea, or when you watch YouTube on the couch, even though you've put on your running shoes. Not dealing with the things you've sworn to deal with is a classic kind of akrasia. Is akrasia real? Does it make sense to say that you decided to do one thing but did another? Or have you simply decided to do the thing you actually did? The philosopher Donald Davidson argued that akrasia often results from the tension between our smaller scale judgments and our all things considered conclusions. On a small scale, we might know that cake is bad for us and decide that we will not eat any more. On a larger scale, it's the holidays and your mother baked a cake and you've had a hard December, and so, all things considered, a second slice sounds good. It is not that your will is weak, but that you've taken a wider view. A version of this dynamic may explain why we cannot deal with our biggest problems. Hamlet famously vows revenge on his uncle Claudius for the murder of his father, but then he dithers, delays, and generally goes crazy, only killing Claudius at the very end of Shakespeare's longest play. Literary scholars have written essay after essay remarking on Hamlet's delay, and he has been widely understood as a flawed person, too melancholy and intellectual to do what he's decided to do. Yet, arguably, this is a bizarre view. Yes, in a narrow sense, Hamlet has concluded that he needs to kill his uncle. But in a broader, all things considered sense, he's reluctant to become a killer himself. This is an entirely sane way of behaving. It's how we ourselves would hope to behave. It's only within the confines of a revenge thriller that Hamlet's actions seem odd. Hamlet holds two lessons for those of us who are struggling to deal. First, we might have good, or at least defensible, reasons for not getting a move on. If we can't articulate them, that could be because we're following a script that's too constraining. It's fine to question the script. Is that your old report still necessary? Second, it's possible that, in order to deal, we need to change in ways we might appropriately resist. Dealing often requires toughness, even a kind of callousness. Years ago, I taught in a master's program, and one of my students, a colonel in charge of thousands of soldiers, told me that, in his view, leaders weren't much smarter than everyone else. Instead, they were willing to make decisions under conditions that others found paralyzing and able to accept the consequence of those decisions, good or bad. Throw out those movie posters. Junk those files. Thrust your sword through that curtain. If it doesn't work out, at least you made the call. A few years ago, Kate Woodford, a lexicographer, wrote a short blog post for the Cambridge Dictionary about phrasal verbs for managing problems. In addition to dealing with a problem, she noted, we can sort it out, work it out, get around it, put up with it, live with it, tough it out, stick it out, wait it out, and sit it out. Dealing with it implies an element of head-on confrontation, and there's a harsh, blunt aspect to the phrase, evoked by the deal with it meme, in which a pair of sunglasses descends onto a grumpy cat or a squinty celebrity. The idea is that you have to adjust yourself to my preferences. I took your parking space. Deal with it. Elections have consequences. Deal with it. Telling someone to deal with it like this only works when you don't actually care whether they do so. But there's another sense of dealing with things which centers on a give and take. When we say that a salesman excels at dealing with customers, that a teacher is good at dealing with kids, or that a politician knows how to deal with her enemies, we mean that they adroitly handle the thorny peculiarities of other individuals. So maybe when a problem needs to be dealt with, it's almost as though it's an individual, too. Ultimately, dealing with difficult things requires getting to know them. It can be hard to really wrap yourself around a quirky and recalcitrant problem. It's a little like hugging in winter, when people wear big coats and seem to have a lot in their pockets. You often have to contort yourself into an awkward embrace. And embracing something briefly won't help you really deal with it. You have to stay there, settling in. You need nuance, persistence, flexibility, firmness, attention to detail, almost a love of the problem. You'll have to become old friends before you can say goodbye. Next, from the December 30th, 2024 edition of The New Yorker, Annals of Inquiry section, how much does our language shape our thinking? English continues to expand into diverse regions around the world. The question is whether humanity will be homogenized as a result, by Manveer Singh. In 2010, a new goddess, about 2 feet tall and cast in bronze, was set to appear in a village within the Indian state of Uttar Pradesh. She looked nothing like the deities of Hindu mythology. In lieu of Durga's bright saris or Lakshmi's opulent jewels, she wore a wide-brimmed hat and the robes of the Statue of Liberty. She wasn't riding a lion or a swan. She stood on a desktop computer. Instead of a sword or a spear, she held a pen in one hand and the Indian Constitution, with its promise of legalized equality, in the other. Her name was Angrezi Devi, the goddess English, and she was intended for India's Dalits, or untouchables. The goddess English can empower Dalits, giving them a chance to break free from centuries of oppression. Her creator, the prominent Dalit writer Chandra Ban Prasad, declared. He saw English as an immensely valuable resource for the Dalit. Will English-speaking Dalits be expected to clean gutters and roads? He asked. Will English-speaking Dalits be content to work as menials at landlords' farms? An atheist, he designed the goddess in order to infuse English into the Dalit identity, propelling his people from a feudal subaltern standing to the ranks of the modern and independent. Learning English has become the greatest mass movement the world has ever seen, he wrote. He had a point. An estimated 1.5 billion people, roughly one in every five human beings, speak English, making it the most widely used language in the history of humanity. With an official status in the UN, NATO, the World Trade Organization, and the European Union, it reigns as the dominant lingua franca of the world, Rosemary Solomon writes in The Rise of English, Global Politics and the Power of Language, published by Oxford. Like other colonial tongues, it spread first through conquest, conversion, and commerce, she notes. But its spread today is powered by a fourth process, what Solomon calls collusion. Around the globe, people pursue English and the opportunities it promises. Korean mothers move their children to Anglophone countries to learn in English, Solomon observes. Dutch universities teach in it. ASEAN countries collaborate in it. Political activists tweet in it. The expansion of English naturally evokes angst and opposition. Solomon, a law professor at St. John's University, focuses on the political and legal tensions that accompany the diffusion of English. France, for example, fought for decades against English's dominance in the European Economic Community and then in the European Union. If, with the arrival of the English, French no longer were the first working language in the community, the French president Georges Pompidou warned in 1971, then Europe would never be totally European. Nearly half a century later, in 2018, President Emmanuel Macron declared English to be too dominant in Brussels and vowed to ramp up efforts to teach French to European officials. In part, such apprehension reflects unease about the erosion of various cultural identities. Yet, many researchers find another reason to worry about the spread of English: the prospect of cognitive hegemony. Languages, they argue, influence how we perceive and respond to the world. The idiosyncrasies of English, its grammar, its concepts, its connection to Western culture, can jointly produce an arbitrary construction of reality. Speculation about these effects is widespread. Prasad, for instance, thinks there's a kind of egalitarianism that's inherent in English and missing from its Indian alternatives. Hindi is full of caste biases, he told me. Idioms, phrases, sayings, jokes, songs belittle Dalits. How can any Dalit take pride in the so-called native tongue? Other intellectuals, such as the Kenyan writer Nguya Wa Thiong'o, maintain that English serves as yet another tool to entrench British and American culture. Pierre Bourdieu, the celebrated French sociologist, voiced a common concern when, in 2001, he wondered if it is possible to accept the use of English without the risk of one's mental structures being anglicized, without being brainwashed by linguistic patterns. Was he right to worry? Everyone can agree that language affects thought. If I told you that I have a pet badger and 22 canaries, you'd have new thoughts about my home life. The real question is whether a language itself has features that affect how its speakers think. Does conversing in Spanish for a month make objects seem more gendered? Does speaking English rather than Hindi make you less casteist and maybe more capitalist? Today, questions like these tend to be associated with Benjamin Lee Whorf, a fire insurance analyst who studied linguistics at Yale in the 1930s. History has been both kind and unkind to him. On the one hand, his name has become synonymous with a theory about how language affects thought, though it predated him by at least a century. On the other hand, the version of the theory often attributed to him is so radical that few modern scholars would want the honor anyway. Whorf laid out his views in an essay titled The Relation of Habitual Thought and Behavior to Language, contrasting the way time is discussed by English speakers as an object that can be quantified and divided, and by Hopi Indian speakers as a more continuous process, or so Whorf believed. He suggested that linguistic differences contributed to differences in how each group understands temporal flow. Despite the boldness of his claims, he was also cautious, proposing merely traceable affinities between language and behavior, nothing ironclad, and stressing that he was, quote, the last to pretend that there is anything so definite as a correlation, end quote. Unfortunately, that nuance has usually been forgotten. Whorf has since become the mascot of linguistic determinism, the position that language is the ultimate arbiter of thought. Whorfianism, as it's sometimes called, quickly dissolves into absurdities. If your language lacks a proper future tense, tomorrow will be inconceivable. If your language lacks certain emotion words, you will never feel them. Pre-verbal infants, orangutans, and all other creatures incapable of language are, by implication, powerless to perform many basic mental operations. Whorfianism has been the target of relentless discrediting. Some of the most striking counterexamples involve individuals unable to produce or comprehend language. Take the case of Brother John, a 50-year-old French-Canadian who suffered from spells of aphasia. Even during periods when he lost the facility of language, he mostly got along fine. According to a 1980 study published in Brain and Language, he could manipulate complex tools, follow instructions he'd been given beforehand, and sometimes succeed in hiding his impairment from others. The Harvard cognitive scientist Steven Pinker has had much to say about Whorfian fallacies. He has shown how common experiences, like searching for the right word or inventing a new term for an existing intuition, invalidate the idea that language always precedes thought. Writing in The Language Instinct in 1994, he concludes that Whorfianism is, quote, wrong, all wrong, end quote. That's a fair assessment if we are talking about the strongest interpretation of Whorf's arguments. Yet, the picture emerging from the latest research is more complicated. Whorfianism is wrong, but it isn't all wrong. Each of my languages comes not only with its own patterns of sound and methods for arranging words, but also with its social habits and its judgments about what to forgive, what to condemn, and what to revere. Julie Sidivi writes in Linguophile, A Life of Language Love, published by Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. Born in what was then Czechoslovakia, Sidivi grew up in a linguistic bedlam, hopping between Austria and Italy before settling down in Montreal. She was acquainted with 5 languages by kindergarten and went on to study how people learn and process language. Science suffuses her book, yet, as a way of knowing, it coexists with experience. The resulting volume isn't so much a standard pop sci book as it is a rhapsodic meditation on loving, taming, and forgetting words. She senses that distinct cognitive styles are tied to the different languages she speaks, comparing them to personalities bickering for the spotlight. I am a cacophony of voices, influencing each other, at times assisting each other, at times getting in each other's way, always vying for turf, she writes. Testimony from polyglots like her has invited a more sophisticated take on Worf's ideas. What if language is less like a yoke than like a wind, nudging us in various directions? This moderate approach, which is more in line with Worf's original perspective, is known as weak Worfianism, or paradoxically, neo-Worfianism. Some neo-Worfian studies have already become classics. One, led by the psychologist Jonathan Winiver and published in 2007, took advantage of the fact that where English has the word blue, Russian has 2 basic color terms, Golubой, lighter blue, and Синий, darker blue. Russian speakers in the experiment proved faster than English speakers at distinguishing shades that corresponded to that lexical distinction. Other such studies exploit variations in, for instance, how languages talk about temporal duration, long and short, as in English, or big and small, as in Greek, or the ordering of events. B following A, as in English, or B below A, as in Mandarin. Testing whether those differences correlate with performance on experimental tasks. Many linguists remain unimpressed. In the anti-Worfian polemic, The Language Hoax, published in 2014, John H. McWhorter of Columbia University describes this research as mostly showing, quote, eensy-weensy differences of the sort that one might find in the cosseted context of a psychological experiment, end quote. Caleb Everett, an anthropologist and psychologist at the University of Miami, arrives at another conclusion in A Myriad of Tongues, published by Harvard. Like Sidivi, Everett was reared in a morass of languages. The son of the missionary-turned-linguist Daniel Everett, he spent much of his childhood in Brazil. His parents intermittently took him to the Amazon to stay with the Paraha, a people legendary for speaking a language devoid of words for numbers and colors, which contributed to his lifelong fascination with linguistic and cognitive diversity. Everett's book is about the surprising ways that languages differ and about the significance these differences may have. He starts by covering Worf's favorite topic, time. English speakers instinctively split time into categories of past, present, and future, but many others don't. Quechua, an Amazonian language Everett studied 2 decades ago, has 2 tenses, future and non-future, while another Amazonian language, Yagua, seems to have 8, including for events that occurred between a month and a year ago, for events that are about to happen, and for events expected to happen further into the future. More relevant for Worfianism are the metaphors people use to organize time. For English speakers, time is understood spatially, with the past typically behind us and the future ahead. Aymara, an Andean language spoken by millions of indigenous Bolivians and Peruvians, likewise uses space to talk about time, but favors a metaphor about sight. In Aymara, Naira, or last year, translates literally to something like the year I can see. The past, visible, thus stands in front of the speaker, while the future, unseeable, looms behind. Ancha Naya Pachana, or a long time ago, can roughly be translated as a time way in front of me. When researchers analyze videos of people chatting, they noticed that the metaphors inform gesture. With fluent Aymara speakers pointing backward to talk about the future and forward to talk about the past. Spanish speakers from the same region show the opposite patterns, suggesting that language configures how speakers map time onto space. Aymara speakers are far from unique here. Speakers of Lisu, a Tibeto-Burman language, also talk about the future as lying behind them and the past as in front of them. Everett tells us that Yupno, a language spoken in the eastern New Guinea highlands, invokes a three-dimensional analogy. Like a gravity-defying river, the future is said to flow up mountains while the past flows downhill. As with Aymara speakers, the metaphor manifests in gesture. How Yupno speakers point depends on the orientation of the nearest mountain range. Some cognitive scientists have assumed that all humans, whatever their local quirks, reason about time using spatial metaphors. Yet at least one language, Tupi-Kawahib, evidently lacks any mapping between time and space, not left to right, back to front, or downhill to uphill. When Tupi-Kawahib speakers were asked to organize objects to chart out the seasons of a year, researchers struggled to understand the arrangements the speakers had created. More than communication tools, languages help concretize the abstract, providing frameworks for making sense of concepts as fundamental as time. Of the many topics Everett covers, which include space, number, and object categorization, the most fascinating is probably sensory vocabulary. Western writers have long assumed that human beings have an inherently limited capacity to describe some senses, with olfaction ranking as the most elusive. We can speak abstractly about colors, red, blue, black, and sound, high, low, loud. With smell, though, we usually give source-based references, like cut grass. But the cognitive scientist Asifa Majid, now of Oxford, and the linguist Niklas Burenhult of Lund University in Sweden, have shown that this need not be the case. They discovered that the Jahai, hunter-gatherers living at the border of Malaysia and Thailand, have a rich vocabulary of abstract smell words. For example, they report that one Jahai term, itpit, refers to the, quote, intense smell of durian, perfume, soap, acacia wood, and bearcat, end quote. Another word, C-N-E-S, applies to the smell of petrol, smoke, bat droppings, and bat caves, some species of millipede, root of wild ginger, leaf of gingerwort, wood of mango tree. Subsequent research has found large olfactory lexicons in at least 40 other languages, among them Fang, Khmer, Swahili, and Zapotec. It makes a difference. In a study that Majid and Burenhult conducted a decade ago, Jahai and English speakers were asked to identify and name 12 smells, including cinnamon, turpentine, gasoline, and onion. English speakers, despite their greater familiarity with the odors, faltered. They mostly gave rambling source-based answers and showed almost no agreement among themselves. One English speaker, presented with cinnamon, responded, "I don't know how to say that." Sweet, yeah. I have tasted that gum like Big Red or something tastes like. What do I want to say? I can't get the word. Jesus, it's that gum smell like something like Big Red. Can I say that? Okay, Big Red. Big Red gum. But Chahai speakers named smells with relative ease. They used abstract terms and were much more likely to converge in their responses. In a follow-up study, wine and coffee experts performed just as badly as novices when given non-wine and non-coffee smells, suggesting that Chahai's enhanced abilities are not simply a result of practice in attending to aromas. Rather, the regular exercise of sorting the olfactory world with abstract labels seems to change how the Chahai understand all smells, familiar and otherwise. The work on olfaction is a tiny part of a large research program, much of it headed by Majid, that has overturned the scientific consensus on how humans talk about the senses. At least since Aristotle, many writers have posited a sensorial hierarchy. Seeing and hearing are said to be the most salient to our minds and the easiest to verbalize, followed by taste, touch, and finally smell. Contesting that thesis, Majid and her colleagues have developed a measure called codability, which captures how easily a sense is expressed. Codability is high when members of a language community converge on one or two abstract labels to describe a stimulus. Ask English speakers to tell you the color of a stop sign, and you'd expect high codability. It's low, in contrast, when people provide diverse, protracted, and ad hoc descriptions, as when, say, you ask English speakers to describe the smell of a rutabaga. Majid and her team measured codability for the five senses in 20 far-flung languages, including three unrelated sign languages. English, the only spoken Western European tongue in the sample, was also the only one to exhibit high codability for sight and hearing and low codability for everything else. Rampant variation reigned, the researchers found. English speakers floundered when talking about touch in response to sandpaper, felt, rubber, etc. But speakers of certain other languages, such as Dogul Dom in Mali and Siwu in Ghana, tended to agree in their descriptions. In many languages, including Lao, Farsi, Yucatec, and Cantonese, taste turned out to be the most expressible sense. As researchers look beyond English, close relatives like Spanish and German, and other so-called behemoth languages like Mandarin and Arabic, they encounter differences long thought impossible. 20 years ago, abstract smell vocabularies seemed ridiculous. Berenhult studied the Chahai language for a decade, even writing a doctoral dissertation on its grammar, before Majid asked him to run a battery of tasks that revealed Chahai speakers' exceptional way of talking about smell. Other linguistic features, once assumed to be universal, such as tenses, personal pronouns, and even, potentially, a distinction between nouns and verbs, have turned up missing when greater numbers of languages have been scrutinized. Likewise, we've enlarged our sense of the metaphors used to map concepts. English describes acoustic pitch using a verticality metaphor, high-low. But a study by experts in musical cognition found that people around the world use at least 35 other mappings, such as small-big, alert-sleepy, pretty-ugly, tense-relaxed, summer-winter, and, in the case of some traditional Zimbabwean instrumentalists, crocodile, low-pitch, and those who follow crocodiles, high-pitch. Everett's book revels in such discoveries, which multiply the conceivable differences separating languages. In a recent review of the research literature, the language scientist Damien Iblasi along with Mahid and others, listed the many cognitive domains that English seems to affect, including memory, theory of mind, spatial reasoning, event processing, aesthetic preferences, and sensitivity to rhythm and melody. Languages help shape the worlds we inhabit less through a few grammatical rules than through countless subtle distinctions. John McWhorter might have been right that the effect of any single linguistic feature is minor. But as Isaac Newton realized when developing calculus, innumerable tiny effects create large-scale patterns. Prasad's Goddess English was meant to debut on October 25, 2010. She was supposed to inhabit a temple of black granite, its walls engraved with scientific formulas and the names of great English writers. But the big day never came. The district government blocked the temple's construction. Prasad recalls a local official hinting that the decision came from Kumari Mayawati, then the chief minister of Uttar Pradesh. Mayawati, who is herself Dalit and who had statues made in her honor while in office, enjoys an almost mythical status in the Dalit community. An Indian journalist reported rumors that Mayawati had blocked the temple because she wanted only one Dalit goddess in the state. After she left office in 2012, Prasad hoped construction on the temple might resume. It didn't. 5 years later, Uttar Pradesh elected Yogi Adityanath, a monk and a Hindu nationalist from the Bharatiya Janata Party, otherwise known as the BJP, as its new chief minister, and the prospect of a shrine to English may have dimmed further. The BJP has ruled India since Narendra Modi took power in 2014. The third of a tea seller's six children, Modi is a departure from the pedigreed English-speaking bureaucrats who govern India for most of its post-independence history. Modi rejects the secular, hyper-diverse vision of the country set forth by Gandhi and Nehru, and has been intent on reshaping India into an explicitly Hindu nation. Language has been central to that project. English is depicted as a symbol of the country's imperialist past and disconnected elites, while Hindi, the Sanskrit-derived language of the masses, has been recast as an avatar of common identity. Despite the fact that only about 40% of Indians speak Hindi or one of its many dialects. Although Prasad disagrees with the ideologues of the BJP about the proper place for English in India, they all agree that English is powerful. Putting aside the economic opportunities it unlocks, they see the language as a psychosocial force, one that is rooted in its foreign origins and that, rather like Hinduism's divine triumvirate, can create, sustain, or destroy social orders. Bourdieu's suggestion that the spread of English represents a form of cognitive hegemony is one that Prasad and the BJP accept, whether as a blessing or as a curse. Yet, we can attend to the recent research into cultural psycholinguistics without ascribing so much authority to English. The language is far less unitary than we often suppose. The version of English that the BJP seeks to weaken differs considerably from whatever the British first imposed some two centuries ago. It's a language enamored with the progressive tense, as in I am going to school every day, and whose pronunciation is transfigured by retroflex consonants, say dog, but curl your tongue back until it resembles a fishhook, and unaspirated voiceless plosives, say kick without expelling air, and in which kindly do the needful and prepone our meeting to tomorrow itself, nah, is a typical request. Honorifics like ji, sir, and sahib are mobilized to accommodate local nuances of deference. After centuries spent fermenting in the subcontinent, English has turned Indian. Such local reworking is ubiquitous. In Singapore, English bred with Malay, Tamil, Hokkien, and other Asian languages to produce that Lawfield tongue known as Singlish, a Creole that non-local English speakers struggle to follow. 7 years ago, the BBC began offering news online in West African Pidgin English, which is spoken by more than 100 million people and influenced so strongly by local African tongues that some linguists consider it tonal. There are countless examples like these in which English scaffolding has adapted to the demands and the cultural heritage of its speaker, from Jamaican Patois to Tok Pisin of New Guinea. For that matter, few tongues exemplify the ever-evolving nature of language better than the so-called Standard English, which, after millennia of conquest, conversion, and commerce, has acquired a vocabulary that is roughly 70% non-Germanic and a simplified grammar that facilitates its spread among adults. Bourdieu was right that linguistic patterns affect us. Yet, going by the best ethnographic and social science research, his fear of brainwashing was overblown. If ways of speaking can alter ways of thinking can alter ways of speaking as well. The dynamic interaction between the two is part of the ongoing story of how we try to make the world intelligible to us and to make ourselves intelligible to one another. Talk about the human conversation. And now, from the New Yorker's 2024 in review, the weird new normal of Donald Trump in 2024. Radical revisionism is a strong contender for the theme of this disruptive year, in which some unique property of political alchemy managed to transform a defeated and disgraced ex-president into a perfectly electable Republican candidate, by Susan B. Glasser. On Christmas Day, Donald Trump issued his traditional holiday greeting, posting on Truth Social, the social media site created to serve as a platform for both his personal enrichment and his political aggrandizement. He reprised his threats to reclaim the Panama Canal from its current state of being controlled by the country in which it exists, tweaked Canada as America's future 51st state, pushed his plan to purchase Greenland for national security purposes, and wished a Merry Christmas to the radical left lunatics he so recently defeated in, quote, the greatest election in the history of our country, end quote. Would it be too 2016 of me to suggest that this is absurd, embarrassing, worrisome stuff? As 2024 ends, the prevailing attitude toward the manic stylings and overheated threats of the once and future president, even among his diehard critics, seems to be more one of purposeful indifference than of explicit resistance. Call it surrender or simply resignation to the political reality that Trump, despite it all, is 25 days away from returning to the Oval Office. A year ago, a Trump victory was far from inconceivable. The grimly anti-incumbent mood of the American electorate and the former president's almost comically easy dispatch of a host of GOP primary challengers who were, for the most part, afraid to criticize him, suggested that it was not only a possible outcome, but even a likely one. Yet, it is also true that as 2024 began, Trump's win was far from inevitable. An alternate reality that, like the half of the country that could not countenance his return to office, has been erased from the Trumpian narrative about his unprecedented and powerful mandate. In the weeks since Election Day, it's been as if Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and all the polite technocratic debates of their polite technocratic administration have vanished into the mists of time. Were the past 4 years in Washington all some strange dream sequence, like the entire season of Dallas back in the 1980s? Radical revisionism by Trump and on his behalf is a strong contender for the theme of this disruptive year, in which some unique property of political alchemy managed to transform a defeated and disgraced ex-president facing four criminal indictments into a perfectly electable Republican candidate with a quirky communication style, a host of more or less legitimate grievances, and a plan to make America great again by empowering his billionaire sidekicks and rolling back laws, regulations, geopolitical trends, and social norms that he and his voters don't like. Rewriting history, relitigating old fights, plain old revanchism, these worked for Trump in 2024, and it's a safe bet that, along with revenge and retribution, they will be the themes of the new Trump administration that takes office on January 20th. Whether it's peremptory attacks on a 1977 Panama Canal Treaty, whose terms he now wants to reject, or the resurrection of 19th century economic protectionism, or the fantastical reimagining of the January 6 rioters who stormed the U.S. Capitol as innocent martyrs, Trump is a conservative in an entirely different sense than the one we have come to know. He is not a Republican who sticks to the status quo, but instead a would-be strongman whose attachment to a past of his own imagining will now, once again, become the country's governing ideology. Every year since 2018, I have written a version of this year-end letter from Washington. What is striking, reading back through them now, on the eve of Trump's return to the White House, is not so much his continued dominance of our politics as it is the consistency of how he has accomplished it. The manic governing by social media pronouncement, the bizarro news cycles, and the normalizing of what would have previously been considered the politically unnormalizable. Even his targets are remarkably similar year in and year out. The radical left lunatics, windmills, Justin Trudeau. In Trump's 2023 Christmas social media post, he wished the nation a happy holiday while praying that his enemies, quote, rot in hell, end quote. What we have managed to forget about Trump in these past few years would fill entire books about other presidents. This year-end exercise has been a small effort in trying to remember. This strikes me as more important than ever in 2024, after an election year in which tapping into the American capacity for collective forgetting proved to be one of Trump's superpowers. Many of the year's signal events were so dramatic that they don't need much recounting now. Trump's unprecedented criminal trial and his 34 felony convictions in a New York State court last May. The incoherent June 27th debate that effectively ended Biden's career. The attempted assassination of Trump as he spoke at a rally in Butler, Pennsylvania on July 13th. And the remarkable images of him thrusting his fist in the air and mouthing fight immediately after a bullet grazed his ear but spared his life. It was just a few days later that Biden dropped out of the race, reinvigorating Democrats with sudden hope that they might beat Trump after all. Only to have Harris, despite a surge of joyous online memes and more than $1 billion in campaign contributions, suffer an even bigger defeat to Trump than Hillary Clinton's shocking loss to him in 2016. Even the subsidiary plot lines of 2024 were epic, from the specter of the world's richest man leaping around Trump's rallies like an overheated schoolboy, to the scorching success of a Republican ad campaign that portrayed America as a dangerous hellscape of invading illegal immigrants, rampant inflation, and intolerant leftists eager to force transgender surgery on your children. Soon after the election, Trump tried to appoint Matt Gaetz as Attorney General, even knowing that the Florida Republican had been investigated by his own congressional colleagues for paying a minor for sex, a choice that resulted in one of the fastest implosions of a cabinet selection in modern history. We will not soon forget all that. Where Trump benefits more from this failure to remember is in the common practice, among his allies and detractors alike, of disregarding much of what he says and does, whether it is his vow to close the U.S. border and begin the largest mass deportations in American history on the first day of his presidency, to end the war in Ukraine in 24 hours, or to nullify the Constitution's guarantee of birthright citizenship. So that's what I'm most hoping does not get lost in this apathetic moment, when his enemies are averting their gaze and his allies are so confident in the imminent arrival of a MAGA utopia that they have little need to sweat the details. A new Associated Press poll released Thursday says 65% of American adults now feel the need to limit their consumption of news about politics and the government. The great tune-out is real. Heading into 2025, I do not believe that warnings about the dangers of an unchecked Trump are overstated. Instead, it is the creeping sense that Trump is entering office largely unopposed that more and more worries me. It is a major warning sign, among many, that the ideological policing of Trump's adversaries is as shrill, hysterical, and hypocritical has been so very effective. I am bracing for impact and not only fearing, but expecting the worst. But while Trump may now believe himself so powerful that he can rewrite history on his own behalf, it is also fair to anticipate that his past will serve not only as prologue, but as precedent for 2025. If neither the American voters nor the Republican Party could stop Trump, his many personal weaknesses just might. Presidents, especially second-term presidents, often stumble. Many occupants of the White House find themselves bogged down in scandal and infighting, victims of their own overreach, hubris, or just sheer incompetence. This was the story of the first Trump administration, and there is plenty of reason to believe that it will be what happens in his second term, too. Should one root for failure of an American president? Half of the country, Trump's half, did this to great effect in 2024. In 2025, it will be everybody else's turn. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. Have a happy new year. So long, everybody.